It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Wisconsin DNR is considering a change for commercial and recreational trout fishing in Lake Superior. The goal would be to allow lake trout quota updates to match up with fish population changes in the lake.
The current process for setting limits could take a while to put into practice. The proposed changes aim to allow speedier updates to keep up with those changes in the fish population.
So what does all this mean for people who fish, who eat those fish, and for the local economies connected with the industry?
Brad Ray is Lake Superior Fisheries Supervisor with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Brad, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you.
And Sharon Moen is a food fish outreach coordinator with Wisconsin Sea Grant, a statewide program dedicated to stewardship and sustainable use of the nation's Great Lakes and ocean resources. Sharon, thanks for joining us.
I'm happy to be here.
Brad, let's start with these changes. Gave a very broad overview. What is the DNR looking at changing when it comes to how we count our trout and then set those fishing guidelines?
Yeah, so the main point of this change is we're going to use the methodology in the rule as opposed to the actual number. And so we'll be able to go to the Natural Resource Board and kind of expedite the process to them having approved quotas, as opposed to currently what we have to go through is the whole rule change every time we adjust that actual number that's in the rule.
Now, for people who fish recreationally or commercially or want to fish commercially, what would be the impact of this change?
So on the recreational side, with the current quota change, it's actually going up. And so there's going to be less chance of a closing the season early. So we have a lake trout quota for the recreational side, and that quota, if we meet that over the course of the year, we close that fishery early. So with this increase that we're thinking that the population is doing really well, so we can increase that, there's less chance of us closing the fishery early. On the commercial side, obviously they'll be able to catch more fish as well, but how we regulate the whitefish, which is the primary commercial target, they'll actually be able to catch more whitefish. Because they'll be able to use more effort because of the lake trout, of how we manage that population.
Sharon, you watch these issues, both the sustainability of fish in the lakes, but also making sure people have access to fish when the numbers are good. What do you make of these changes? They may sound subtle to people not familiar with this. What do you see as the potential impact here?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that we have a world-class fishery, both commercially and recreationally, and that includes the charter captains, and that it's because of the great management that, not only the Great Lakes Fisheries Commission, but also, the Wisconsin DNR have been able to execute, and that this rule change will allow the DNR to be more nimble in responding to changes in the fish population. Because I don't know if the listeners know, but in 2022, there was this Cisco boom that a record number of Cisco were hatched in the lake. And so we have just these great restoration stories to tell, and that, our citizens can benefit from this.
You mentioned another fish that I've mentioned, the lake trout. That's more of a household word. Cisco, I admit, Sharon, I went online to look at the Cisco. I couldn't pick it out of a lineup. For those like me not familiar, talk about the Cisco and our commercial and recreational fishing for it.
Yeah, so many people know it as tulipy or lake herring. It has a number of different names, bluefin, but it's more of a middle of the food web kind of fish that the lake trout eat. And so we have all these Cisco now. And so the lake trout are getting to be record sizes because they're just gorging on all these Ciscos that are out there. And again, locally, you might know them as lake herring.
Brad, can you talk a little bit about what it takes to set the right balance? When we see a big jump in numbers, like say for Cisco or other fish, how do we then set our harvest guideline, if I could use the word, to make sure that we don't overcorrect and bring those numbers back down to a too low level?
Yeah, that's a good question. And so what we have is we have a set of different population models that we do independent data collection. So the DNR is out there aboard the RV Hacknoise, collecting data independently of the fisheries. We also collect data from the commercial industry and the recreational side. And we're able to get that fishery dependent, the commercial and recreational side data, as well as the fishery independent, our assessments, and create a population model that kind of tracks each of the populations. So we have a population model for whitefish, we have a population model for lake trout, and we're working on a new management strategy population model for Cisco. And this increase that Sharon just mentioned of the 2022 year class is really going to help learn a lot about what's going on. This unprecedented size, Lake Superior hasn't seen anything this big. The biggest that we're even talking about close is back from the 70s. And so we have, we work really close with our tribal partners on the cooperative management of this, and we're monitoring the population. And that means we have a good idea of what we think's out there. It's hard to count every single fish, but we have a good idea what's out there. We know what's coming out. And then what we're hoping for is the perfect conditions to pull off a year class like it did in 2022 that can ripple through the population. So we have all that food out there that then the predators like lake trout are going to do really well.
We are talking about commercial and recreational fishing and how we manage it in Lake Superior. Brad Ray with us from the state DNR, Sharon Moen from Wisconsin Sea Grant. Sharon, zooming out a bit, when we look at all of our commercial and recreational fishing in Lake Superior, what is the economic impact? What does that mean for our economy, especially in northern Wisconsin?
Oh, you're catching me out on, like, I don't know exact numbers, mm-hmm. but I do know that you know, a lot of our coastal communities were built around fishing. And so if you travel, you know, from Superior, Wisconsin to the other edge of Lake Superior through Cornucopia and then to the Bad River area, these towns rely on fishing. And most of the whitefish that they catch and fish that they catch is consumed locally. And this type of thing supports the communities that they're in, but also the health and well-being of the people who eat these products because of, you know, Lake Superior just has such spectacular water. And the fish that come out of it are healthy and really good for you. A lot of omega-3 fatty acids because it is a cold lake. So the omega-3s kind of build up in their system. So it's economically so important for these small communities like Bayfield and Cornucopia and Red Cliff.
And Brad, as Sharon mentioned, the water quality in Lake Superior, mostly we're talking about, you know, managing fish populations based on how many fish we take out. But how about concerns about you know, the future of water quality, water temperatures with climate change, invasive species? Are there any of those things lurking on the horizon that you watch as we set our quotas?
Obviously, the big invasive species that everybody might have heard of is sea lamprey, and sea lamprey are still an issue in the Great Lakes. We work with our federal partners on sea lamprey control, and they do a great job of kind of suppressing those. But we did see a little uptick after COVID when they weren't able to get out as much. And so we were monitoring that to see if those numbers come back down after that little uptick of mistreatments in 2020. We saw in Lake Superior high numbers of sea lamprey both in 2023 and again in 2024. And so that's still going to be a concern because those sea lamprey are actually that end up being the top predator in the system and attack our lake trout and our lake whitefish and even our Cisco. They'll attack and consume those fish. And obviously conditions matter, and we saw less harvest recreational of lake trout last year because we didn't have ice. And so the perfect conditions that were in 2022 were a long, little bit colder winter, good ice conditions, slow warm up into June. And those perfect conditions, those are going to be hard to control. And so as climate change becomes an issue, we are going to have to be nimble and be able to adapt to how that affects these cold water fish species.
Sharon, I know historically we've seen in ocean fishing some cases of over-harvesting in the commercial fishing industry. You work, I understand, with commercial fishers in Lake Superior on sustainability issues. Can you talk a little bit about those conversations and how they're working to not over-harvest their livelihood?
Correct. Well, they are all interested, I mean, the tribal fisheries as well as the state licensed fisheries, in not overfishing. They have children they want to pass their businesses to, and they're part in I think every case I can think of, a long line of commercial fishing families. So they really respect the resource. And though, you know, they might argue with Brad sometimes, they respect the DNR and their ability to manage the fish so they can have these amazing products to sell. So that being said, the industry has been green rated, at least our Wisconsin Commercial Fisheries, World Wildlife Fund, Sweden has gave it the green light. So, you know, the Cisco season is coming up, and that is where the they call it Great Lakes Gold caviar comes from. So the Cisco fisheries is about ready to start. And then also the Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch has re-ranked our fisheries as green, which means best choice because of the way they're sustainably managed and harvested. So, I mean, our fishers are doing a great job of following the rules and responding to, you know, the DNR changes. I think
Brad, what's the timeline for the change and how we set these quotas?
Yep. So we have a hearing on the rule change on November 5th. Then in December, we'll take the rule to the Natural Resources Board. If it gets approved there, it will go through the legislative review and hopefully be in place by March of 2025, March or April.
We'll leave it there. Brad, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Sharon, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Sharon Moan is the Food Fish Outreach Coordinator with Wisconsin Sea Grant. Brad Ray, Lake Superior Fisheries Supervisor with Wisconsin's DNR. And again, a hearing on those changes coming up on Tuesday, November 5th.
Up, check out the role of Wisconsin's electors in the presidential race and efforts to prevent attempted fake elector schemes that came up in the 2020 election.
And there are some additional safeguards in place in 2024 that would additionally protect against that being used to overturn an election.
That's next on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This presidential election has seen a surge in the number of campaign volunteers.
According to the Wisconsin Democratic Party, more than 16,000 volunteers signed on once Vice President Kamala Harris rose to the top of the ticket.
Nationally, the Harris campaign said over a single week in October, volunteers knocked on more than 1.2 million doors and made more than 20 million phone calls.
But how effective is the strategy known as the ground game? And what is it like to knock on your neighbor's door only to find out that they are supporting the other side?
We reached out to both the Harris and Trump campaigns to see what it was like to canvass in an area that leans opposite of your chosen candidate.
We only heard back from one, so last week we landed in Waukesha County, third most populous in the state, has voted for a Republican going back at least the last six presidential elections.
We begin at a house in Delafield. Mackenzie Crummy reports.
Hello. Is Paula available?
I am Paula.
Hi, Paula. My name is Kathy. I'm a volunteer with the Lake Country Democrats. How are you doing today?
That is Kathy Lopez. She's been volunteering with the Democratic Party since she moved to Wisconsin more than 2 years ago.
Jim's here for watching the Packer game.
I know.
Of course.
I guess. I think you might be the last house for me because I don't want to interrupt people.
We're in Delafield, a city in the reliably red Waukesha County, where Donald Trump took home 60% of the vote in 2016 and 2020. This is her fifth canvassing shift this week.
I do have a guest with me today.
I'm Ms. Kenzie Crummy. I'm with Wisconsin Public Radio.
She said when she is preparing to walk up to a door, she is trying to approach it like a conversation with a neighbor. She isn't trying to have a confrontation or waste anyone's time.
I can count on probably one hand, one or two hands, I guess. I've done a lot of doors. How many times someone leans away from respectful. But even then, it's usually not like a big confrontation. I think for me, the thing that I've tried to learn over time with canvassing is just how long to keep the conversation going, you know? Because these are really emotional and passionate issues, and just trying to figure out where, okay, you know, where should I cut it off and say thank you and move along?
Lopez said the perception of Waukesha as a Republican stronghold is changing. Recently, Mayor Sean Riley, a Republican for most of his life, endorsed Kamala Harris. Lopez describes herself as a blue dot and says she isn't the only one. As we knock on more doors, it turns out she's right.
As a Christian, I don't know how anybody could vote for Trump.
Can we count your support for Kamala Harris?
Yeah.
I'm for all the Democrats.
Awesome. Up and down the ballot?
Yeah.
Great. You know, we've been walking around today, and there are so many more Harris supporters in this area than I thought. So.
I know. I'm really encouraged this year. I even had one of my Republican girlfriends just tell me yesterday she voted for Harris. So.
Yeah.
Yay. Very happy.
Okay.
For more than 2 hours, we walked around the area known as Lake Country. We knocked on 19 doors and had a conversation with 9 people. Every one of them was a strong Harris supporter. The Trump campaign and state Republican Party are also getting their ground game out around Wisconsin. We reached out hoping to shadow a canvasser, but had no success. And we know as the election draws closer, the Waukesha County Democratic Party is targeting households that lean left. But Lopez said this is one of the best days she's had.
Honestly, today was probably one of the strongest days in terms of Harris supporters. And I do think, like I said, the closer we get to the election, the more we're really targeting in on people that are likely a Harris supporter. But this has been the most consistent all the way across the board, which is just, that's what you want when you're getting closer to the election. So that's good. It means people have made up their mind and they're ready to get out there and vote. So that's good.
Lopez feels talking to neighbors and door-to-door canvassing really works. Even in the scenarios when she encounters a Republican or an undecided voter, she said it's mostly polite, and sometimes that's all it takes.
I absolutely feel like going door to door is an effective strategy. I remember in my training, they were talking about how these deep canvassing opportunities where you're really trying to make connections are the things that change people's minds. They are the things that really make a difference and move the needle. You know, they say here in Wisconsin that 1 or 2 votes per ward that come out for your candidate can make the entire difference in the whole election.
As a former educator, Lopez said she enjoys talking with voters and encouraging people to participate in the democratic process. She plans to continue canvassing up until the election and has already voted at her local city hall. As we approach one home, a mother and her children are outside enjoying the weather, and an 8-year-old boy wants to share his thoughts on voting in the state.
What did you learn about voting in your literature there?
Mostly that voting is super important. Whoever we're voting for, we need to make the right choice and that they need to help out Wisconsin.
Mackenzie Crummy for Wisconsin Public Radio.
And special thanks to Sarah Hopeful for technical direction on that story.
Now we turn to electors as Democrats and Republicans in Wisconsin selected their slates of potential 2024 presidential electors last month in the run-up to Election Day.
This is a pivotal moment since 4 years ago, 10 Wisconsin Republicans declared themselves as electors for former President Donald Trump, filing paperwork falsely saying he had won Wisconsin.
We're taking a look at the role of electors and changes in state and federal laws since 2020 in the electoral process. Brenna Gadar is a staff attorney with the State Democracy Research Initiative at the University of Wisconsin Law School. Brenna, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the basic role of electors. They were pretty invisible, I think, in a lot of ways up till the last few years. We don't technically elect a president when we cast our popular vote. How do the electors fit into the whole equation?
That's correct. So when you're casting your vote for a candidate on the ballot, you're actually casting a vote for 10 presidential electors who are selected by the same party as that candidate. So, for example, the Democrats and Republicans have each selected a list of 10 electors who then will vote on December 17th for the candidate that wins. So for example, if Harris wins, the Democratic electors will go to the Capitol on the 17th and cast their votes for Harris. And if Trump wins, the Republican electors will do the same thing.
And both parties did this last month. They chose their slate of electors. Does it work pretty much the same around the country, or are there variations from state to state when it comes to choosing those slates of electors?
There are variations state to state. Each state can determine how electors are selected. But in common, pretty much, they are all the political parties selecting those electors. The process of how that happens varies a bit. So in Wisconsin, it is state legislators, state office holders, and also candidates for those offices from each party gather to nominate electors. That's a little bit different from some other states where there is a state party convention or a state party committee that determines those electors. But in all states, pretty much, the electors are typically state and local officials, party leaders or activists, folks who the party knows will cast a vote for their candidate.
Now, most of the time, this is sort of a, you know, abstract civics discussion. These things just kind of work automatically as far as voters can tell. Then came 2020, and Wisconsin was one of a handful of states where Republicans in states where they lost, these electors signed statements saying, yeah, we're the electors. The electors themselves said, well, it was just in case courts overturn things, but it ended up being part of a wider thing going on. Can you talk a little bit about the so-called a fake elector scheme?
Like you said, in 2020, when Biden won Wisconsin and a number of other battleground states, what that meant for Wisconsin is the Democratic electors met and cast their votes for Biden as required. But what happened with the fake elector scheme is the Republican electors who were not selected then also met and signed a certificate saying that Trump had won the state. And that was later used as part of an effort to overturn the election. But I think it is worth noting that it was not successful in 2020, and there are some additional safeguards in place in 2024 that would additionally protect against that being used to overturn an election.
Yeah, let's get to those safeguards. What kind of changes have we seen since that effort in late 2020, early 2021?
The biggest change is the Electoral Count Reform Act, which was a bipartisan piece of legislation at the federal level that really sought to address some of these weaknesses that we saw in 2020. And one of those changes is that Congress has to treat certifications from a state's governor as conclusive as to the result of the election, unless courts say otherwise. So what that means is there's sort of this step in this process where the governor issues a certificate with the results of the election in Wisconsin, and that sets the slate of electors who will be casting the valid votes. And so that means that Congress has to count the votes of the candidate who actually won the state and can't turn to sort of a fake certificate in order to overturn the results.
Are there other changes at that federal level that you see as significant in the process of going from Election Day to the electors signing that to Congress certifying those electoral slates?
Some of the changes involve sort of updated timelines and just making sure that there's an expedited process in federal court for resolving challenges or potential issues. And then the ECRA, this Electoral Count Reform Act, also really emphasizes that states have to appoint electors in accordance with state laws that were enacted prior to Election Day. So another thing that we heard about in 2020 was this idea that state legislatures could step in and override electors' votes. And the ECRA really says, no, you're not allowed to do that after the fact. You really have to stick with the laws that you had in place before the election.
We are talking about the role of electors in the upcoming presidential election with Brenna Goddard, staff attorney with the State Democracy Research Initiative at the University of Wisconsin Law School. Brenna, people may have seen headlines from around the country where the so-called fake electors, some of those Republicans who signed elector documents, were on the list of their party slate of electors again now in 2024. Not in Wisconsin, though. Why not?
That's correct. So in Wisconsin, there was a civil lawsuit, not criminal charges, but a civil case brought against the slate of 10 fake electors from 2020. And the electors settled that lawsuit in part. And part of that settlement was they agreed not to serve as presidential electors in 2024 or in any other election where Trump is on the ballot. And that settlement also included an acknowledgement that their actions were part of an effort to overturn Biden's victory and an acknowledgement that Biden did actually win in Wisconsin. And so as a result of that settlement, those fake electors won't be serving in 2024.
Another issue with electors over the years is a thought that, okay, so say I, Rob Ferret, end up on a slate of electors. I haven't and I won't. But if I did, and maybe I changed my mind. You know what? I don't like my party's candidate when all is said and done. I'm going to switch my electoral vote. Some states have said, no, you can't do that, Rob. What is the state here in Wisconsin?
Wisconsin says you cannot do that. But this is something we have seen elsewhere. Interestingly, in 2020, there were no faithless electors, is sort of what that's referred to as. But in 2016, there were 7 faithless electors who cast their votes for somebody other than the party that had selected them or the candidate for whom they were supposed to vote. And Wisconsin law and a majority, I think nearly over two-thirds of states bind electors to vote in accordance with the state popular vote.
Every year we have a big presidential election, I always see articles from countries other than the U.S. who look and say, okay, well, wait a minute, somebody can win the popular vote but lose in the Electoral College, which has, of course, happened a couple times in the last couple decades. Why, the foreign observers ask, do you do that? So why? What's the reasoning behind having the Electoral College? And this goes back, obviously, to the founding.
Yeah, so it's definitely in line with how things were set up for representation of small states in particular. So the way the Electoral College breaks down is you get a number of electors based on your congressional delegation, which is for each state, you get 2 senators plus the number of representatives that you have in the House. And representatives are apportioned roughly based on population, but senators are not. So large states and small states alike have 2 senators. And what this means is the minimum number of electors you can have as a state is 3 electors. And this leads to major differences and disparities in population and sort of how much your vote counts toward each elector vote in different states. So for example, in Texas, California, Florida, New York, when you cast your vote, it's going to a much smaller share of elector votes than in smaller population states like Wyoming, Montana, or Rhode Island. And then the other piece of this is that most states distribute their electors on a winner-takes-all basis. There are only 2 states that will actually split up their electoral votes. That's Maine and Nebraska. And what this means is if the vote is very close in a state, like, for example, in Wisconsin, it was in 2020, all 10 votes are still going to one candidate. It doesn't get split up based on the proportion of votes that each candidate gets in the state. And that's where you can see the popular vote result being different than that Electoral College result.
Now, 2020, people saw in some ways as a stress test on our election system, the mechanisms from what happens from Election Day until that certification by Congress. You've mentioned some of the changes at the federal level to limit some of those efforts. What kind of things do you have your eye on in the event that a losing candidate wants to unlose? They want to try to change the outcome in states like Wisconsin.
One thing to watch is the recount process. We saw in the last 2 presidential elections, recounts happening in Wisconsin. One change that happened in Wisconsin after 2016 is that you can only ask for a recount if you are within 1% of the leading candidate. So basically, you only get a recount if the results are pretty close, which was the case in 2020 and could very well be the case again in 2024. But I think it's worth emphasizing that there are a large number of procedures and detailed procedures in place, both for the initial ballot counting process and for the recount process, to ensure that we are getting the correct results reported and that those are the results that are ultimately getting certified by the governor and voted on by our presidential electors and going to Congress.
We focused mostly, of course, on Wisconsin here and changes in federal law. As we mentioned, the fake elector plot involved other states, battleground states around the country. Are there states you have your eye on when it comes to how they've handled the fake elector issue, whether through prosecution or civil lawsuits or some of those fake electors, as I mentioned, getting back on their slates of electors?
Yes. So in several states, there are criminal cases actively pending against fake electors. For example, in Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, there's cases going on. But I think, and I should also say, and there are, like you said, I think about 14 fake electors serving again in various states. But some of those federal law changes should reduce the potential for negative fallout if those folks do decide to cast a fake certificate again in the event of a Harris win. I think the some of the other issues that folks are watching is just efforts to perpetuate claims of voter fraud in a way that has the potential to undermine confidence in the election. And incidents of voter fraud are incredibly low, but we are seeing, for example, in Georgia, a number of election administration policies and state officials sort of perpetuate the idea that voter fraud might happen. And that has the potential to lead to more uncertainty and unrest following the election.
Brenna, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Brenna Goddard is a staff attorney with the State Democracy Research Initiative at the University of Wisconsin Law School.
WPR will bring you live special coverage on election night. Join us Tuesday starting at 6. We'll share results and analysis from around the country and around Wisconsin. You'll hear updates on key races from WPR's own reporters and Rob Ferret.
That's me.
Yeah.
That's live coverage on election night here on WPR and online at WPR.org. Join us starting election night at 6.
Coming up, the new leader of a literacy center in Oshkosh came to the U.S. from Myanmar without English skills and is a role model now.
It's a constant reminder that if I have been able to be here, they could also be successful in this new country amidst all these things that they have lived through.
Literacy is a lifeline. That's next on WPR News. You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a poem about Dia de los Muertos, which is being celebrated around the world today.
Dia de los Muertos is a day for people to come together and remember their loved ones who have passed. They may set up ofrendas or altars with photos, flowers, and food. Poet and Milwaukee native Carl Michael Iglesias explores how Latinos manage their grief during this season through his poem, The Altar.
The Altar. The altar is a release of the shoulders, an apartment locking up to keep the light in. What lace cloth? What walkway? What veil? We light the candles together like at a wedding, and all our guests are dancing. And all our guests are settled spirits. Brass and wooden frames. A last smile in a cold desert. Into soft dust a skeleton key turns. All of our guests are a field of families we have gathered as flowers. All of our guests are ghosts. A gathering of old frames that rest cheek to cheek. If the dead can learn to live on, why can't we? The altar is prime real estate. The rest happens here, as if one day we will join the quiet rest. The altar roars as audience, as starving stomach. No one had to die for the altar, but the altar honors the dead. more people will die, and the altar will master the grief with candles. The altar is orange with marigolds. The marigolds are orange like an altar on fire. Mask over an aging face. How chill masks the desert, the way the earth covers our body. The altar is where we meet, where your grandpa teaches you English and mine talks God to me in Spanish. God invented the altar, and the altar invented the flame, and the author, and the mourning. And I've been thinking a lot about you asking, why is everyone dying? I gave you a candle, and you gave me a black lighter. I should not have responded with a quiet desert, should not have retreated into frame, a fireplace. I let you heavy sleep for 2 more hours, and you kissed me on the way back to the kitchen, lit a humble incense. The reason we all have to die is to find a more accessible love. Welcome, welcome, welcome. We met at the altar, the distant faces in our faces, a lasting field coming to visit, to see us together.
That was Carl Michael Iglesias reading his poem, The Altar. It's part of his newest collection of poems called The Bounce. After he recorded his poem for us, I asked Iglesias to explain the inspiration behind The Altar.
The inspiration for The Altar came from a conversation with a loved one when they asked, why is everyone dying? Poetry has always been my way of tapping into the questions that don't have easy answers. So at that moment, I had no idea what to say. But writing the poem gave me a second chance to try an answer. It helped me understand that we all need a process for this kind of grief. And many of our ancestors have already provided us with traditions and rituals that guide us forward, while helping us also remember the people we were lucky to have in our lives. Many creators, including myself, are navigating their own grieving process, but we're also offering something larger. We turn to songs, films, poems that remind us grieving is ongoing, and with its power to bring people together, challenges us to heal collectively.
Carl Michael Iglesias is a poet and writer who grew up in Milwaukee and now lives in Brooklyn. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lolan Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Wisconsin Today.
Our next guest has taken a journey from her native Myanmar to New York and finally to Oshkosh.
Along the way, she learned how to read and write in English with the help of a literacy council in New York. Now she's paying it forward by leading a similar organization here in Wisconsin.
Chu Mei Ping is the new executive director of the Winnebago Area Literacy Council. She's an anthropologist and was recently an honorary associate fellow at the Center for Southeast Asian Studies at UW-Madison. Chu, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you. Thank you for welcoming me to your studio. Yes.
Chu, you came to the U.S. from Myanmar about a decade ago, and at the time, you spoke very little English. What was that time like for you?
Yes, I came to the U.S. about now 12 years ago, and I came because I win the diversity visa lottery, which also sometimes referred to as green card lottery. So, you know, I was just not expecting to move to the U.S., but my mom picked New York City for the place for me to move because, you know, it's diverse culture and for various reasons for the new immigrants, right? So I was at the time 19 and I arrived there and I just started working in restaurant jobs. So I would say it was kind of a, how do you say, you know, I've seen only New York cities in the movies and things like that. And after arriving there and of course, you know, working in the blue collar jobs, exactly, it's kind of shattered the the kind of quote unquote, so to speak, the American dream, right? What it's like to actually be part of the immigrant labor force in this bustling and busy city. So yeah, that was kind of a lot to take in. But after a year or so, I was able to go back to community college and, you know, finish my education and of course finish my grad school. And yeah, so it's been quite a journey. Yes.
What a journey to a PhD. You found help, though, early on with English skills at a literacy center in New York. What did the center offer you?
So I remember I would go there and just, you know, start taking English classes, and I make some friends there, and all of them are also from all over the place. So actually, it really helped me kind of also to go back, to be able to go back to school, right, to even to think about filling out applications and applications to CUNY, right, City University of New York. Mm-hmm. So I would say it was really essential for me to be able to kind of take classes like that. And I would say that's also why I was able to, you know, complete my education after all of that. So yes.
We're going to fast forward all the way to the present. How will these life experiences early on in a new country influence your leadership of the Winnebago Area Literacy Council?
I am very excited. So I've been here at the Literacy Council here in Oshkosh for just 1 month. But for the past 1 year, I have been on the board of directors, and I also volunteer as a tutor, a one-on-one tutor for one of the learners here, because I always have my eye on that target, so to speak, to be able to volunteer my time to people like myself, right? Mm-hmm. Like people who are here just kind of new and just trying my best to donate my time to be able to help those people who are in the same boat as me.
Can you put a face on some of their stories? Where do people in these classes in Oshkosh come from? Can you share a little bit about their backgrounds?
Yes. We now primarily serve a lot of immigrant and refugee communities here. So, for example, our classes are filled with people from, you know, Congo, Syria, people from my own country, Burma, most of them Rohingya, right? And also people from Iran, Iraq. So a lot of our learners' demographics comes from places where there has been a political conflict, right? Mm. And those communities who have been resettled in Oshkosh, and many of them will not even have a literacy skill in their mother languages. So for example, just a few weeks ago, we accepted one learner, right, a family, and they are Rohingya, and they came through Malaysia. And so the father is in one of our classes, and the mother and the kids are in our women and children classes. And the mother and the kids, they do not even read their own Rohingya language, right? And the father speak Burmese, so I can kind of speak to him in Burmese a little bit, but he also doesn't read or write Burmese or Rohingya. So imagine having to learn a new language like English, even when you don't even read or write your own language, right? So these are some of our like learner story. And of course, it varies. We also have learners who are, you know, exchange research scholars at the University of Wisconsin-Oshkosh, you know, people from one of our learners, for example, is from China, and he's an established and published chemist. Right. Oh, but English is his second language. So he's also taking some of our classes here. So it's really a wide range, I would say. Yes.
We're talking with the Winnebago Area Literacy Council's new executive director, Chu Mei Paing, about her experience learning English as an immigrant over 10 years ago and what she brings to the council in Oshkosh. Chu, I'm thinking about the ongoing civil war in your home country. What has it been like for you as an immigrant to have this conflict happening in your country? Are you able to be okay and stay in touch with your family there?
Yes, that is also another big struggle for myself, I guess. Yes, so my whole family is still back in Myanmar. And I'm the only one in the U.S. So I'm also trying my best, right? I think one of the ways in which I find joy in the work that I do here at Winnebago Area Literacy Council is every day my work involves helping out an immigrant, a community member or a refugee community members. And sometimes I come across to people from Burma. So that also kind of reminds me always every day when I work with them that I am contributing something to my own community, even though it's all across the world, right? For example, a lot of our older refugee women would remind me of my own mom. If my mom were to come here, she would be in these classes sitting and trying to learn English, right? So it's a, I don't know how to explain this feeling of these people are not my family, but in a way they remind me of my family. Yeah. And that is also why I'm doing this job, right? So in a way, I feel quite fulfilled, even when my family is stay far away. And I know that we are stay in the midst of the war right now, and a lot of people stay being killed and a lot of people are stay being displaced. So, but this is the actionable action that I could take here.
I wonder, when you look back at winning the green card lottery at age 19, that you would picture yourself where you are now, holding a cultural and linguistic anthropology PhD, being a leader of a literacy council. Could you envision that?
No. Short answer would be no. I would have never thought that I would be in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, and I would be the executive director at the Winnebago Area Literacy Council. But I was also raised a Buddhist, so I believe in karma, and there is a concept in Buddhism called, in Burmese, we say tandaya, or in Pali is sansara, which is a cycle of life. So I do believe that I'm in this position because somehow my life has completed a portion of the cycle. So that's also why I'm here, and it's kind of things are falling back into place and there is a purpose.
When you landed the job, you talked about paying it forward. And I wonder, how would you like to make your mark as executive director of this literacy council?
Yes, yes. I do believe in paying it forward even before I joined the literacy council as the executive director. I just want these learners to also feel and think that they could recognize something in me. If I could recognize my family in them, I hope they could recognize something in me when they look at me and who I am and what position I'm taking. So I think in a way that is also paying it forward, that it's a constant reminder that if I have been able to be here, they could also be successful in this new country amidst all these things that they have lived through. You know, the world is their oyster now, so to speak. Yes.
The world is their oyster. And sounds like you want to give them a very positive outlook. Do you find that there are job opportunities for the learners who go through the Literacy Council and gain those English skills?
Yeah, so actually one of the programs that we also offer is a vocational literacy service, working with this local community funder called United Way. So United Way specifically fund that particular program at the Literacy Council to help us, you know, find jobs for these learners. So we have been having very success with that program. So 80% of our learners in that programs are able to find jobs and then stay on those jobs, right?
80%.
Yes.
Yeah. Chu, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you, Kate.
Chu Mei Ping is executive director of the Winnebago Area Literacy Council. She talked with us about her story as an immigrant from Myanmar and how she's now helping other newcomers learn English and build a life in Oshkosh.
Stakes are high on Tuesday's election day, and so is the level of stress for many voters.
A new survey from the American Psychological Association finds more than 3/4 of adults say the future of our nation is a significant source of stress in their lives.
And we want to hear about the state of your mind heading into election day. What are you feeling? How are you coping? Does the upcoming election day compare to some other time in your life, for better or worse?
Call or text. Get in touch with us. The number is 888-642-0232, or you can email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
And thanks for taking the time to share your perspective.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.